Welcome to Food Conversations, Season 3. Food Conversations is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, with a special emphasis on building up the local food supply and establishing food security and sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. On each program, I interview people who are playing a role in increasing the amount of healthy local food available to citizens in this area. Before we continue, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Jedediah Weeb to Food Conversations. Jed is co-founder with his partner Louise of Elderberry Grove Farm, which produces and sells 28 varieties of what are known as Sambuca plants, also known as elderberry, as well as elderberry jam, syrup, and juice to many satisfied customers. Welcome to our show, Jed.
Hello. Thank you so much, Warren. It's wonderful to be here chatting with you today.
Well, we're delighted to be conversing with you on Zoom, where you can sit in comfort in your own home, and we can sit in this spacious and luxuriously appointed studio owned by the Voice of the Shuswap Broadcast Society. It's a little bit Spartan for luxurious, but hey, who's counting? Anyway, as listeners to this show know and understand, most people in this part of the world, and for that matter, everywhere else, come to what they're doing now by following that long and winding road we call life. And so today, as we have done with most of our guests on Food Conversations, we're going to explore how Jed and Elderberry Grove came to be where they are today. In particular, we're going to talk about the role of values, higher values, and how to live one's life. So, Jed, it all began for you in this life in Telegraph Creek, the mighty metropolis of Telegraph Creek. Now, I don't think you remember too much because you left there at 3, but you went back, and what did you see when you went back to Telegraph Creek?
It's just a beautiful place. It feels, it's out in the wilderness, and it's a place where you are so connected to nature. It's so present and it's in your face. There's tremendous geology all around you, and you have to watch where you step because it's really on a cliff at the edge of a fast-flowing river.
The Stikeen River rushing by and ready to carry you off to the ocean if you happen to make a misstep.
It is impressive.
Well, I think there are parts of the world where Mother Nature is more obvious than the human habitations that it's embedded in, and that's probably a good place to get a start. It makes you aware that there's more than just us living on this planet. Now, you were born into a family that, by the time you came along, was pretty much embedded in adventure and exploring the world. Now, your father was originally from the Mennonite tradition, which, not surprisingly, has led to you having a name with Mennonite resonances. But when he married your mother, things changed. How did that change in terms of his life and her life and his involvement with the community, Mennonite community?
Yeah, you know, as far as I know, after my parents were married, they didn't spend much more time in with the Mennonite community. They were more interested in traveling and, working in far northern locations and small communities.
Did your dad ever tell you why that was? What was this wanderlust, this need, desire to go out and see the world? Was that because they were in Saskatchewan?
I'm not so certain that I could give an answer to that question, but I do know that both my parents just loved the mountains and loved to be closer to the nature that they found in rural areas in the north. And when they eventually moved to BC, they really fell in love with the forest and the mountains and the lakes and streams and the all the animals they encountered there.
It's interesting. When I first moved here, I found that half my medical colleagues in Salmon Arm were from Saskatchewan as well. So I think there's an inherent attraction in this change in scenery, the variety that occurs in this part of the world, and which is why it's a very popular place for many people to come to. Your dad was a teacher, and your mom was became an outpost nurse. And that must have facilitated travel. Those are both service occupations, and you can go anywhere where there's children to learn and people in need of help with their health. Do you think that really facilitated their travels?
That's a keen observation, Warren. I think that it did, and I wonder perhaps it even factored in their decision to choose those careers, mm-hmm. because they certainly utilized the opportunity that those careers gave them to live in interesting and remote locations before they came to Salmon Arm.
Yes. Well, even though they formally left the Mennonite community as a geographical location, they remained involved a lot with Mennonite institutions that serve the broader community. I'm thinking of the Mennonite Disaster Service and others. Maybe talk about that a little bit, because it was sort of a dichotomy. There were engaged with the Mennonite spirit, if you like, but moved out into the broader community.
I think that's really true. I think that there are a lot of fantastic values in the Mennonite community, specifically pacifism, that really resonated with my parents. Peacefulness. I mean, my sister was given the name Shalom, which means peace.
Yes, indeed.
So it would be fair to say that has had an impact on my parents, and back to you, because you should maybe remind me the question.
It's early in the morning, there's barely light, so who's counting again? One thing you said to me when we were talking before the show was that they sort of became black sheep in their families, and yet black sheep in this context has some, it's different from the usual connotation of people who completely reject or are rejected by their families. That obviously didn't occur. What kind of unusual black sheep were they?
Well, my parents were just interested in being different, doing things that were unconventional. Mm. They, got married on a beaver dam with just their siblings present, and they I think what I meant when I said that they were kind of black sheep in their mm. family was simply that they were the ones out of all their siblings in both cases, for both my parents, who had the most strongest interest in the environment and in caring for the planet, just sort of like a real passion for them.
Do you have any idea? I mean, over the years, you've had a chance to observe your parents in various contexts and settings. Do you have an idea what made them? What was the source of that totally admirable and fascinating sense of, I don't know, adventure, travel, move away, do something different? I mean, I know, as you said earlier, we talked about Saskatchewan versus the geography of Saskatchewan versus the geography of Telegraph Creek and British Columbia in general, and the world. I mean, there's a lot of different geographical formations in Saskatchewan. The prairies are flat and they stretch on for miles. I mean, they're extraordinarily beautiful. But did you ever get it? And you don't have to answer this question if you don't know the answer, because it may be inscrutable. But do you have a sense of why they They had this, they became exemplars of this way of living, of kind of restless travel, moving around, rethinking things.
Somehow I knew you were going to ask me something like that. I was thinking about it this morning, and it's so hard to know, seeing as how they're not right here today with me, and I couldn't just
query them.
Ask them. But I feel like, my parents feel, I can tell that they feel a deep empathy towards, a lot of things, towards nature and towards other human beings. And I think that just their love of nature and wanting to spend time in nature, as they did throughout their life and on their adventures, I think may have been connected to that. I mean, just seeing the incredible beauty of nature and seeing what we've done to it, kind of we've really reduced the amount of habitat for plants and animals to live in. Just, I think, may have invoked a deep sense of empathy in them, and it really attracted them to spend time with it and give it value in their daily choices.
Yeah. Well, on a more practical level, they bought a hippie van. Some speculation when we were talking earlier that it might have been the proverbial Volkswagen Westphalia, but even if it wasn't, it was of that ilk. It was a vehicle to travel and live in a sort of self-contained way, and they did travel. Talk about how far they went. They went lots of places.
So their first hippie van that they bought, they bought in Europe, and they spent 2 years traveling Western Europe, the Eastern Bloc, and Africa. I know they made it to at least 80 countries, and maybe a little higher. As well as, I mean, they also later they backpacked in South America, but they I think that was maybe the beginning of the 80s,
right.
The 70s.
Yeah.
It was Europe, and they got to see, they had a desire to travel. And I think my parents taught me as a teenager that traveling helped you to learn to see things from other people's perspectives.
Right.
And that may have been what drove them to want to travel, but they have, through their whole life, had an insatiable desire to experience new things and meet new people.
Which must have made it easy for you to fall into that pattern.
Sure. When I graduated, my parents said, we'll buy you a camera and a backpack. And they sent me off the very next day. I actually, on before bed after prom, I had arrived in Austria and began a 9-month solo journey as a 17-year-old in Europe.
I'm trying hard not to laugh, but I am finding it very difficult because it is an extraordinary beginning to your independent life, you know, physically independent life.
Yeah.
So with an injunction that your parents gave you, the backpack and the camera, it must have been relatively easy, in a way, to leave their 20-acre farm here in Salmon Arm. It must have felt like you were taking off from the nest with adventures waiting you.
I it didn't really even feel like an option. It just was.
Well, were you scared?
It seemed like that. It just seemed like that's what you do after you graduate. You immediately go traveling. A little family tradition. My older sister did that as well. I didn't even have time to be scared. It sure was fun. It sure was exciting. It was a very exciting day.
You remember that day? That day, the farewells on the porch or whatever.
Yeah. To be honest, that day started writing an exam, and it ended up traveling on a train in Austria. And graduation ceremony and prom was in between.
And how did you get to the train in Austria? Did you paddle across the Atlantic in a canoe?
Well, I was in an airplane, which is something I try to do as little as possible now because of my concern about climate change. But that was a thing to do in the early aughts.
What they put in your backpack, my guess is values. They put in notions that had been part of, as you say, just what you do for a long time. Things like altruism, social justice, you know, helping others. And I guess there must have been books and material around when you were growing up that you could look at and imbibe some of these values from.
Well, yeah, I couldn't really say like how my parents got to be the way that they were, have the ideas that they had, but they sure wanted to share their values with us when we were young. And that I remember that did a lot of that started with the literature that they picked out for us. You know, the books that they read to us were, it was such a common theme with social justice and just learning about the history of the world and learning about how we need to have empathy for other people and care for the experiences that they've gone through and make sure that the world doesn't repeat. I mean, some of the books that were read to us seem a little heavy for such a young person, but my parents deemed that it was okay, and you know, I guess we were ready for it. We learned to have, well, they at least tried to teach us empathy.
They worked there to keep you off the streets and out of the drug scene. They thought that would help. It's interesting. You taught me a phrase when we were talking before the show. You taught me a phrase that I wasn't familiar with, and my mind went to Twitter when you told me, but you explained what it actually meant, and that is red letter Christian. A red letter Christian. In the midst of saying, I'm a totally secular, and I'm not an atheist, but I'm open-minded, and I'm a deconstructionist of religion, all sorts of descriptors, you also said a red letter Christian. Why don't you explain what that means?
So I did grow up in the church and as a born again believer. And later on in life, I began deconstructing my beliefs and my worldview about, my worldview. Let's leave it at that.
Right.
But one thing that I have noticed is the actual teachings of Jesus. So in a red letter Bible, that would be a Bible where all the printing is in normal black ink, but the words that were attributed to being spoken by Jesus are in red. And a lot of people have discovered that there's really good wisdom in there. And so a red letter Bible would have, well, I guess I've already explained that it would have the teachings of Jesus in red. And a red letter Christian, I guess, would be someone who puts value in those red letters. And sometimes I feel like that describes me. I feel like those, if we just looked at the red letters, you know, I would say, yeah, that works for me.
And then peel away all the other stuff and kind of concentrate on that. And it's interesting how you've used these different phrases to talk about, you know, being a deconstructionist. And I think that's, even though it's a lot longer word, it's also a clear word. You take the structures of belief systems and religious systems, and you kind of remove the scaffolding and the bricks, and you see what is at the core of what's going on. And I think that also it would be considered a way to become connected to people all over the world who might have a different structure of their belief system, but would have the same core values. Is that, does that in any way resonate with what you have been pursuing?
That's possible. I haven't really looked at it that way.
Well, the only reason I ask that is because obviously you also went to other people in other cultures and in other parts of the world and found them to be like you, that they were not different kinds of people from different planets and different, you know, fundamentally different from you, that they were very much the same.
I have, in my experiences traveling, which are limited compared to my parents, but I have met a lot of people and have been absolutely impressed with that fact, just what you've said. The people, no matter where they might live or come from in the world, I've found people who are so similar to me in their thinking and their interests, you know.
Sure. You mentioned one person who had inspired you, and that was Karen Armstrong, who is known as a kind of religious historian. One sentence that you shared with me was, the true path to happiness is to dedicate to something higher than oneself. And would that be a little bit of a theme for you and of course your family as well?
I think you could say that. And I find it so interesting because that is fundamentally, at least looking at it from the angle that I'm looking at, that's fundamentally the message of Jesus was, hey, the true path to heaven on earth is to look beyond yourself. Don't just live as a selfish person, but dedicate your life to a cause greater than your own. And you will, it's a scientifically proven method that you'll be happy. And that's been studied by psychologists in Berkeley.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a program now under the auspices of the National Geographic called the Blue Zones Project. And it's a project that goes around the world looking at communities and exploring what results in longer, healthier lives. And one of the principles they have identified is that you look at your life from a distance, you step back from it, and you look to see what is important. And then you look at the things that really matter to you and making sure that you include them, you follow them in your life. So outside, things outside your own immediate world, and your position in the universe, the way we don't always think of ourselves, we think of our busyness and the next project we have to engage in. But pulling back from that and looking at the outer, the whole enchilada, if you like, of life on the planet, gives you a less anxious time. You start to realize that you have broader things to participate in than just your own day-to-day, you know, confusion sometimes, or sense of immediate purpose, but doesn't seem to lead anywhere except to the front door and out to dig a hole in the ground or something very mundane. You put this inspiration into action because you went off to a college in a university college in Nova Scotia called King's University, which now, as I understand, sort of bought out and as sort of an ancillary part of Dalhousie University, but then it was a separate institution. Tell us a little bit about King's University.
It is a really, it's an amazing place. It's an absolute dream to go there. It's I had never felt such a collection of like-minded individuals, you know, kids my age. And it was as fun as being at summer camp for the whole two semesters, you know, with an incredible academic load, an incredible academic focus. You know, we were all going through it together, and we were studying Well, it was advertised to me. My understanding going there was that we were going to study the history of Western thought, which at that time I felt I really needed to know. Mm. Where did we come from? How did we get here? How can I really know who I am unless I know where my culture came from? And once I got there, I ended up learning that calling it a great books program and saying that we would be studying the history of Western literature was really a euphemism for saying that it was philosophy school.
Mm.
But, I absolutely no regrets. It was an interesting experience. Learning about philosophy was really just what I needed. And it was so interesting. There was so much material there. And it totally changed my perspective on my own experiences that I'd seen in life, knowing where they came from and knowing what thoughts came before that helped us come to the ideas that we might now have.
Yeah, there's a certain perception in people that when they come across an idea, it's the first time it ever occurred on the planet. And it's a fascinating experience for all of us to see that other people have thought of these things sometimes thousands of years ago and expressed them very eloquently, and they could have been saying it the day before. How many young folk were there in your class? I guess you would have had a class. How many were there? Was it a large group?
273. And the fun thing about it is basically everyone lives on campus and everybody's taking the same giant class. So normally at university, a full course load is 5 classes. This is, you have one giant class and one elective. And so that one giant class takes up the time and effort of 4 classes. And everybody was going through it. And what they do to you to make it really exciting is you come in to begin the program and you're used to getting straight A's, or at least A's and B's in my case. And, you know, you've left your high school. Everybody's patted you on the back and said, hey, you're a smart kid. And you get there and they start giving you C's and D's. And the pressure to work and achieve excellence is so high. Everybody is so stressed. And you're all in it together. And it turns out to be quite a lot of fun, quite an adventure. And by the end, they... I don't know how they do it, but they somehow your marks get higher by the end.
This sounds like a clever trick by your teachers.
it must have something to do with humility.
Well,
I'm trying to teach that maybe.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because in many cultures, that's how social structures work. You know, Jed, it's interesting, the concept of humility is very much part of indigenous teaching around the world. And just specifically with respect to that, the Kung people, and I can't do a click with my throat, but there's an exclamation mark in front of Kung that represents a click sound with your tongue. When a hunter catches kills an antelope, he doesn't carry it back to the little gathering place where the rest of his community is located. He leaves it there, goes back and says, well, I didn't do a very good job. I kind of, you know, messed up, you know, nothing out there, but maybe you could go out and you find something. And then the elders of the community wander off to roughly where he indicated he had been, and they find the animal, and they kind of have a look at it, and then they come back and they say, well, it's not that great. It's, you know, it's okay, I guess. And then they start to share it with everybody, not the hunter himself, but the elders. And in fact, they share it with neighboring communities. And all the way along, neither the hunter who caught the animal nor anyone else says anything to elevate his opinion of himself and his stature in the community. And the reason is that everybody depends on everybody else. And if somebody is sort of elevated into this high position, he or she will there'll be tensions between him or her and the other people in the community. And in fact, in this particular form of social structure, there are no leaders, but people know who knows a lot. And so as you get older, you become more of an advisor to other people rather than the big chief or the big kahuna. And it's interesting, in your course, you were surrounded by people who were all kind of on this process of, oh my God, we don't know, we're not doing well, we're getting D's, we're getting C's, we're not having what seemed to be this, you know, easy path through life, and you all, and they're doing it together. You're doing it as a community, a community of students. By the way, did the students at this at King's University, did they come from like all over Canada, all over the world, or where did they come from?
Well, that is an interesting question. They mostly come from Toronto. And a few other cities in Ontario, but it seems to me like the university made a little bit of an effort to try and get a few people from each province. And I've often wondered, how did I get into this school with such high academic requirements for acceptance? The reason that they picked me might not have been my grades, might simply been the fact that I might have been one of only two people to apply from BC. So I think I might have been there as the token British Columbian.
You were an exotic creature from a far away locale.
They needed my... they needed me.
Now, on a more pragmatic level, you paid for this because of money you'd earned as a tree planter. Tree planting was something, it was an experience that you wanted to engage in. What was tree planting specifically, as any, there's different kinds of work. What was tree planting all about for you?
Well, I decided to tree plant, really simply to prove myself. I was 18 or maybe 19, and I had something to prove. You know, I knew people who had tree planted, and I wanted to prove that I was just as tough as them. But I also knew that I would find myself feeling at home out in nature. And I had all the plants that I knew and were my friends to keep me company out there. Well, I've always had a bit of an interest in plants, the plants of the forest, and learning their names and what they do and how they contribute to the community of organisms that is the forest.
Yes. And you actually found your way to a, and I didn't even know these things existed, a Christian tree planting company. But it really turned out not to be the kind of fit that somebody else might have thought it would be because of your background with the Mennonites.
Yeah, I didn't end up making the many close friends there. I guess I sort of bonded with one other individual there who was also the kind of person who asked questions and was interested in philosophy. And, you know, the conversations that we had there really turned me to thinking more about social justice values and spending less time thinking about who's right and who's wrong
about doctrine. It seems that that's a theme that has run through many things that we've been talking about so far. This idea that you don't just do. I mean, if you have parents who get married on a beaver dam, you clearly cannot go back and say I come from a traditional. Many people think that they come from the phrase, we just came from an ordinary family. But your phrase would have been, I came from an unusual family, at least as far as choice of wedding locale, if nothing else. But you also wanted to, trees in particular, I'll repeat back a phrase to you that you shared with me. trees became a pillar of my life. Now, why don't you deconstruct the phrase, a pillar of my life, and tell me what that really means.
I picked up that phrase because somewhere along the line, and my understanding is that it means it's just something that you can see that has been consistent and always important in your life. And without fail, as far back as I can remember, I've always loved trees. I can't really explain it. I don't know why. I just really like how they look, what they do. I like the wood that they produce. But best of all, I love planting them. And my definition of tree is quite broad. It includes things as small as, you know, a berry bush. Could be a blueberry or anything. But those plants that come back every year, they may drop their leaves in winter, but they, you know, are sort of a permanent thing in the semi-permanent thing in the landscape, and they sure give back a lot. Did you know that 80% of the energy that a Douglas fir harvests from the sun gets put into feeding organisms in the soil?
I didn't know that exact, but it is consistent with. No, but I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing, and you may have heard of an intentional community forum in northern Scotland called Findhorn, and Findhorn had a local dignitary, actually a local landowner lord, who ended up being called the man who loved trees because he spent his whole life planting trees. And we've heard about, you know, Johnny Appleseed, and there have been other people around, legendary and actual, for whom the planting of trees has been a centerpiece of their lives. I think there's nothing more wonderful than a planet covered with trees. And in fact, we are now studying the role the trees play and how important it is to replace them and nurture them everywhere on the planet, because they bring special energy into our world and store it and share it with us. Just a little diversion ahead to talking about Elderberry Grove. You have a hobby zone on your farm where you plant trees. Tell us about your hobby zone on the farm, your special sanctuary place.
I don't know how it really came about, but it just, I guess I couldn't stop it from happening. It's sort of the polite way to say it is passion, but I think it's more of, you know, another word might be obsession. Somehow I couldn't stop acquiring new varieties of food producing trees. So fruits, nuts, berries. And I guess at this point I filled up an acre and a half. It's pretty well full. They're all little guys. Guys and girls, but most trees don't have
gender.
One or the other, most of them both. And I wanted to create a big collection, like sort of a repository or a botanical garden that's kind of a repository of edible species that do well here in the Shuswap. And part of that, hand in hand with that, is the knowledge on how to reproduce them. So it sort of makes me feel like I can contribute to food security for the area if I have if I can keep a living collection of these organisms that can provide just endless food for people. We can propagate them out, and so I've been collecting the best varieties of everything that I can that makes food. And at this point, I have a little over 200 varieties of edible fruits, nuts, and berries.
Well, listeners will remember that we interviewed Kelly Westgate and Joel Torrens, Joel Torrens is the director of the Salvation Army site here in Salmon Arm, and Kelly Westgate is an agricultural a contractor who together are setting up a food forest on the Salvation Army property here in Salmon Arm. The same thing that you're doing in a more spontaneous and sort of creative way in your hobby area, your special place. And listeners will probably also remember that food forests have turned out to be the path for discovering the lost civilizations in the Amazon Valley that died off rapidly after the first settlers arrived, but left behind specific concentrations of food trees that later archaeologists were able to show were unnatural and had been created by the populations of that area, as has been done in southeastern United States, what is now the United States. Food forests were actually a central feature of sustenance for many peoples in that area prior to contact. So it's a tradition that's being rediscovered, and I think what's fascinating is that you've rediscovered it just because of your love of trees and your love of planting trees, not by some academic pursuit or, you know, study of history, but just because innately you had a sense that this was a wonderful thing to do.
Of course. I mean, I knew about it intellectually too. I'm so inspired by those traditions. You know, it seems like some even large areas of North America, I understand, were like one giant food forest. Mm-hmm. Permaculture was the way before settlers came and introduced what we now know of as conventional agriculture and the Green Revolution.
Yes.
And it would be cool if my food forest one day, when it matures, is self-sustaining and outlives me. For many generations.
Another
thing would be so beautiful.
It's another thing about trees. They tend to live longer than we do, and it gives us a sense of our place in history, which is somewhat more transient. We don't have a 1,400-year lifespan, or even a 2,000-year lifespan. Now, getting back to some of the things you actually did as a result of trees and wood and your engagement with that, you embarked on an interesting venture in Colombia, in South America, and that venture was going to study. You told me that you didn't want to go to a place where you would be doing the more conventional thing, not so conventional nowadays, but 30 or 40 years ago was absolutely the norm, which is to go and tell those poor people how they could live a better life and be happier. You wanted to go and learn from people in a faraway place. And you went on the internet, and the internet led you to Vicente Lorraine. So why don't you describe how that process worked and what motivated you?
Leaving university, I saw lots of people go and spend a year abroad, maybe volunteering, usually for an NGO, and I guess I just thought I was going to go and volunteer for an individual. I wanted to become someone's apprentice, and that's basically what I did. I volunteered in one guy's workshop.
So in order to live this adventure, you studied the internet. You found out that there was an International Guild of Luthiers, or luthiers, or depending on how you accent it. And that was where you found Vicente. And what happened?
I emailed him, and I said, I would like to come work as your apprentice. And he basically wrote me back and said, okay, I mean, that sounds like a good idea, but why don't you come down here, and we'll see. So I thought, hey, that's perfect. That sounds really cool. I mean, it's more of an adventure if you know, you don't have fixed plans and an agreement and a contract. So I loaded my carry-on and my checked baggage with Canadian tone wood. And for those who don't know, that's just wood that's suitable for building musical instruments. And I figured out later the value of the wood that I brought him was roughly equivalent to what would be a teacher's salary in Colombia.
Did you have an idea before you left that this was, how calculated was that? Or was it just sort of saying, well, maybe this would be a good idea. Maybe I should do this. Or did he say that?
I knew he needed it. He said, you know, could you bring some down? So I brought as much as I could. And I would bring him 2 pieces of wood every week or every couple days. I forget. But it ended up, we got along famously, and he was just interested in all the same things as me, and we had all the same values, and it wouldn't have mattered if I was paying him anything at all. We became best of friends.
Mm. Have you kept in touch with him?
A little bit.
Yeah. And you learned from him about tools. You learned a lot about tools. What did you learn?
Oh, man, we worked with so many tools, and they always had to be working in absolute top performance level. And so we were constantly fixing or even building our own tools. And I realized the thing that stuck with me most profoundly from working with him was that he would say, Jed, this tool, it was made by a person, someone just like you. So believe in yourself. You can figure out how it works. And you know what? Have the confidence to know that you can change it. You can make it better. And if you need to build a tool, you're a person. You're just like all those other people who build tools. You can build your own tool.
You know, this is the exact antithesis of ready-made on the shelf items, and so much of our society is serviced by tools and products and things manufactured that have, there's one size fits all or close to that, and when you get it, that's what you get. You don't get a package saying this is the pair of shoes that we think would fit your feet, but you could maybe fiddle with them, and here's some devices you can do that with. And if your feet aren't comfortable, then you can do this and you can do that to make them more. It's sort of an organic process, it sounds like. The tool-making process.
Oh, yeah. And that is such an important part of my job at Elderberry Grove now is making these tools. And oftentimes they're totally bespoke. They're built for just the one job, and they do that one job just perfectly. And it has given us such a leg up financially. It's so expensive when you're starting your business to, you know, you have to have the tools in order to run the business, and you don't have the money just yet. But so I've gotten around that quite often by just making the tools for vastly less cost. And then ready to go, start farming.
And what you first did, you came back and you set up Jed's Planet Saving Guitars as a business. A business where you made guitars out of tone wood that you had found that wasn't being used by other people.
That's right. I had such a good time. So much fun in Colombia and building musical instruments. I discovered that I just loved spending my time building these instruments. So I thought, okay, it would be great if I could turn this into a job. But I had a profound sense that I needed to have a meaningful impact with my job. It just wasn't, I couldn't make a career. I just didn't feel like I could make a career choice unless I could be doing something with that career that was meaningful and had an impact. So one day I had the idea, I can make really sustainable musical instruments. And I thought what would be even cooler is if I used exclusively upcycled wood. And so sometimes that meant taking a piano, taking it apart and building it into a guitar. And other times that meant finding other businesses online that scoured the world for incredible pieces of wood that were destined for the landfill and saved them. And I was able to purchase that. So in a mix of things. Sometimes people gave me old furniture that was just perfect for making into the back or the sides of a guitar.
Do you roughly speaking, over the roughly 10 years that you were running your business, how many guitars would you say you made?
Oh, that's a good question. Maybe 14.
And do you, have you heard any of them being played?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And for the people who bought your guitars, what kind of an experience was there between? I mean, they knew what you were doing to make these guitars, and they understood the principles behind it, and they wanted an instrument that they could play that would sound good as well. So you that kind of back and forth must have been an interesting experience in itself.
Oh, for sure. I had one gentleman who said, I've been wanting a new guitar, but my wife just, she wouldn't let me. But when I found out that I could buy a sustainable guitar built from recycled wood, she said, okay, well, that, you can get another guitar. Another gentleman, he wanted to celebrate his mother's life and make a memory. I believe she had passed on, and he wanted to make a new family heirloom to remember her by. And so he sent me the wood from his mother's piano, and I turned it into a guitar for him and sent it back. And, you know, that felt really good.
It was so much more in a way than just instrument making as a technical process. It was a process of relationship, from what you're describing, both with the wood and with the people who took the instruments that you had created. It sounds like a very reciprocal kind of business.
Yeah. And I wanted to show people, not just the customers, but I wanted to show everyone that you can build something of truly high quality without without bending any of your ethics, your considerations about sustainability, something that's cradle to cradle. I wanted to show people you can make something that can come into existence without harming the planet.
Sure. As well as building guitars, there was a certain restlessness growing in you, which you described to me as feeling burnt out a little bit. But it wasn't exactly that. It was becoming more interested in other things, or maybe returning to another area of interest and growing things. And you started to hang out with nefarious people belonging to the Young Agrarians. How subversive a group could you have associated with? And you gradually, things started to move in that direction. By this time, you and Louise had been together for some time. You were living in the teepee, of course. Where else would you live? You'd live in a teepee if you have parents who travel light and travel far. And becoming interested in agriculture and growing things. And finally, the penny dropped, and you decided to move in that direction. And you met the inestimable Tessa Wetherill, who coordinates the Young Agrarians program. So talk about that a little bit. That was a seminal process in your life as well.
Well, I pretty soon realized that all my friends were that I had really started to spend a lot of time with in those years were farmers, and it just rubbed off on me. I was still building guitars, but every summer there seemed to be less and less time for building guitars, because more and more time was spent being an agrarian, having the agrarian homestead, grow your own food lifestyle. And I began to plant more and more trees in my food forest. And one day I realized there just wasn't enough time for building guitars anymore. And I was getting a little bit a little bit anxious about going back into that guitar shop. I got kind of developed some anxiety troubles and some burnout, and I realized I'm meant to be a farmer. This is what really gives me life. I just needed to plant things and take care of them. Oh, I love taking care of my plant friends.
It's interesting.
They just need so much nurturing.
Yes, they do. And they nurture you right back, which is another reciprocal relationship. It's interesting that even the phrase burning out came to the fore as we were discussing it. But obviously what was really happening was another process was burgeoning inside you, and it has come to fruition in the form of Elderberry Grove Farm, which you are the co-founder with Louise. And we're going to spend some time talking about that in our next show. And I think the listeners who've heard the trajectory that led you to that can understand why it's not just an ordinary production unit growing elderberry trees. It's a purpose-driven, value-laden operation that is having an impact in multiple ways besides simply just sharing elderberries. Jed, it's been a delight talking to you today. I look forward to talking to you on our next show, and we'll have an equally good time talking about Elderberry Grove Farm. Thank you very much for being on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I look forward to it.